From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Have the wrong men been held at Guantanamo Bay? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The Bush administration calls prisoners at Guantanamo Bay the worst of the worst, but one of its own top officials says at least a third never belonged there. The U.S. Supreme Court says they have a right to challenge their detention, but dissenting Justice Scalia warns that could lead to Americans being killed. On To the Point, out of 770 Guantanamo detainees, almost 500 have been released. 60 more have been cleared. Do they pose a danger? We'll hear about the most extensive investigation so far into who they are and how they got to Guantanamo Bay. On Reporter's Notebook later on, McCain and Obama on drilling for oil. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. The U.S. Supreme Court says prisoners at Guantanamo Bay can challenge their detentions in court. But has the prison for terrorists been holding the wrong men? On To the Point, we'll hear who they are, how they got there, and how dangerous they might be. On Reporter's Notebook, McCain and Obama have similar goals for energy and the environment, but drastically different ways to get there. First, this news update. Hamas said early today that a peace treaty with Israel would be announced, barring any unforeseen developments. Three Israeli airstrikes then killed at least six Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, including high officials of the militant Army of Islam. Isabel Kirshner is based in Jerusalem for the New York Times. Ms. Kirshner, good to have you with us.
Hi.
Does it appear that the strikes will derail the peace deal?
Well, no. These strikes are, in a way, the last shots that Israel will get in before the truce comes into effect. And Hamas and Islamic Jihad and other of the groups in Gaza have reserved the right to respond. So it's quite possible that both sides will be trying to get their last shots in up until Thursday morning. But both sides have made it clear that these incidents won't derail that process.
What then is supposed to happen on Thursday morning?
Well, Thursday morning at 6 a.m., if all goes according to plan, both sides will cease fire. Hamas and other groups in Gaza will stop firing rockets and mortars into southern Israel. Israel will stop all military action in Gaza, which has mostly taken the form of either precision strikes against militant groups or incursions on the ground, which have been very frequent in the last few months. And at the same time, according to Hamas at least, Israel will also immediately ease up on the economic blockade that it has imposed on Gaza since Hamas took over a year ago by opening up the commercial crossings on the Gaza-Israel border.
There have been deals and tentative deals, innumerable ones in the past. Is there reason to believe that this one is any more solid than others that have come before?
Well, not if you speak to Israeli officials. They're very skeptical about how long this will last. One of the tests will be how well Hamas is able to control some of the smaller groups in Gaza and the more radical groups, because in the past, as you say, there have been understandings, and they've usually broken down within months. And often it's been because the smaller groups have carried on their actions, whether it's firing rockets on their own initiative or having been contracted out by the larger groups. This time Israel is insisting that the fire has to be halted totally and completely, and is holding Hamas, which is in control of Gaza, responsible for the actions also of the smaller groups. So there's a lot at stake here for both sides. And as I say, Israeli officials themselves are rather skeptical and are cautioning that even when the truce comes into effect, the situation will still be pretty fragile.
Is the Army of Islam, one of the group of whose members were killed today by the Israelis, is that one of those smaller groups that the Israelis want Hamas to control?
It's a very small and very unruly group. It's a group that has been often at loggerheads with Hamas and therefore has had an incentive in the past to act against the wishes and interests of Hamas. So yes, indeed, that is one of the groups Hamas is going to have to bring under control. The army put out a statement this evening saying that three of those killed today in Gaza were indeed members of that group, and said that they were planning what it called a large-scale terrorist operation against unidentified Israeli targets, which this attack today, according to the army, has thwarted. But it does show that there are other forces afoot.
Prime Minister Olmert of Israel is in big political trouble, in part because of a corruption investigation. Will this be good or bad for him, or with Israelis as skeptical as you say they are, will it make much difference?
Well, to be honest, he's been under a lot of pressure basically to decide. There have been two main options here for the Israeli government. One is to go for the truce, and the other is to take a military path and go for a major offensive in Gaza to try and stop the fire that way. The government has opted for the truce, and I think because of his political troubles and his legal problems and his lack of standing at the moment in the Israeli public, it would have been very hard for him to order a major military operation, which we all know would probably be costly in lives on both sides. So in a way, this certainly is good for him. If it works and it brings quiet to the south of Israel, then, you know, again, it will be good for him and probably improve his standing somewhat.
Still,
but basically, Israelis have been pressing for a choice, a decision to be made either way, and at least this is a decision.
All right. Once again, Thursday morning, 6 a.m., both sides indicate there will be a ceasefire. We'll see if it happens. Isabel Kirshner, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Reporting from Jerusalem for The New York Times. In a moment, are the wrong men being held at Guantanamo Bay? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
We're only back with To the Point. Quote, America's prison for terrorists often held the wrong men. Close quote. That's the headline from an investigative report on Guantanamo Bay by the McClatchy newspapers. They spent 8 months in 11 countries on three continents. They talked with 66 of the former prisoners released from Guantanamo Bay and with dozens of foreign and U.S. officials. They include former Secretary of the Army Thomas White, who said a third of the inmates at Guantanamo Bay should not have been there. The principal writer on the series is Tom Lasseter. And Tom, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Justify that headline, America's prison for terrorists often held the wrong men.
Well, it was clear through our reporting that many of the men rounded up and shipped to Guantanamo, they were often low-level sort of Taliban grunts, if you will, men who had been on the battlefield who might have known or who didn't know how to pull the trigger of an AK-47, but had very little, if nothing, to offer in terms of actionable intelligence about international terrorism. You had two along with them, certainly terrorists and militants, and then you also had men who were not connected with militant groups or activities. You know, were not grunts swept off the battlefield. Were people who had been turned over to the Americans either because of long-standing grudges in Afghanistan and different warlords. Trying to remove competition or because of the bounties offered by U.S. forces in late 2001.
You said a report in your story that seven of them actually worked for the U.S.-supported Afghan government?
Right. Well, we spoke with more than seven who had worked with the U.S.-backed Afghan government, but seven of them were pointed to by Afghan officials, you know, either security or intelligence officials, as people who were not connected with militant groups or activities. And again, you know, Afghanistan, a country where you've got decades of invasion and civil war, and so it's a place where in late 01 and then moving forward, you had people with long-standing political grudges, tribal grudges, factional feuds, who would feed false information through American informants in an attempt to use American forces to remove their opponents.
Did they get bounties for the prisoners they turned in?
Right. Well, that happened particularly in late 2001. U.S. forces distributed leaflets around Afghanistan advertising cash bounties for militants, and the cash bounties went up as you got militant leadership. And so certainly, particularly for Afghan warlords, they had a financial incentive to round up large groups of men and present them as militants, and particularly to present them as militant leaders. And certainly at times they were, but it's clear that at other times they were not.
We're talking with Tom Lasseter, who's a reporter for the McClatchy newspapers, about this very extensive investigation. Well, certainly Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, said to be the mastermind of September 11th, was held at Guantanamo Bay, along with others that do appear, as you indicated, to be real and genuine terrorists. How do you tell the difference, and how did the U.S. authorities go about trying to tell the difference?
Well, I think one number to start off with is that of the 770 or more than 770 detainees who were held at Guantanamo Bay, 500 have been released without charges, and often just released back to their homes, to their home countries, to their communities. I think that's a pretty strong indication that they were deemed not to be international terrorists who posed a threat to U.S. security and interests.
How long were they held?
Well, varying times, varying periods of time. You had men who were held for a year, for a year and a half, and you had men who were held for 4 years or 5 years.
So obviously then, the next question would be, what's the proportion, roughly speaking? If you say 500 have been released, what's the proportion of those remaining, or do you know much about those remaining at this point who might be real terrorists?
Well, I don't know much about those remaining. I've not been able to interview them there at Guantanamo, but certainly there were six cases opened against people for direct tie-ins with planning or involvement with the 9/11 attacks, and that represents, I think, less than 1% of the total population held at Guantanamo.
So the phrase "worst of the worst" was used often by very high officials of the Bush administration. You quote the former Secretary of the Army is saying something very different. Tell us about him.
Right. Well, former Secretary White said that he's talking about at the outset. He said that it was clear that about a third did not belong there. Again, this was the result of Afghan warlords looking for bounties and also just large-scale sweeps of men off the battlefield. And when that, at the time in late 2001, a lot of the senior al-Qaeda and Taliban leadership had already escaped Afghanistan or were in hiding in different parts of Afghanistan. But in eastern Afghanistan, where you had a lot of the fighting, a lot of the people left on the battlefield were again, sort of grunts or we interviewed several guys from Pakistan who had come over to fight, but they were teenagers or they were in their early 20s. You know, these were men who had certainly not been briefed on, al-Qaeda, operational plans. These were men who, again, would have been aware of sort of the piece of ground they were standing on, as they were fighting or many of them never fought as they were headed for the fight. And a lot of them were swept up. And again, these were people who did not have much to offer just by virtue of who they were in terms of operational intelligence that would help us, to target and to take out terrorist networks.
Again, we're talking with Tom Lasseter with the McClatchy newspapers. We'll come back to him. He's going to be with us throughout the program, I should say, and make very clear. We asked the Pentagon and the Department of Justice to participate in our program. They declined the opportunity to do so. One of those who was interned at Guantanamo Bay and who has subsequently been released is Murat Kurnaz. He lives in Germany. He is of Turkish descent. He has written a book called 5 Years of My Life, An Innocent Man in Guantanamo. And Murat Kurnaz, welcome to our program.
Hi.
Tell us how you were arrested and how you got to Guantanamo Bay.
It was in 2001, and I was in Pakistan visiting a school who was helping the homeless, and I was ready to go back home to Germany. It was close to Christmas, and I had already my plane ticket to go back to Germany. And during my trip in Pakistan, I never broke any rules. And then they arrested me with no reason for, and kept me for a couple of weeks in a prison in Pakistan. And one day I had my first interrogation by American government. And later on they brought me over to Kandahar and kept me over there. And after Kandahar they brought me to Guantanamo. And altogether I spent like 5 years in an American prison.
Now you say you were arrested for no reason. Who arrested you and what did they tell you when they picked you up?
It was the only reason why they arrested me was the bounty of $3,000. And the first time I didn't know anything about the bounty. Just during my interrogations later on in Guantanamo, one interrogator, he told me that it's because of the bounty that I'm there.
And who paid the bounty and how did they know about you to pay it?
It was the Pakistani police people did know about the bounty, and $3,000 listens not much money for us maybe, but in Pakistan, for the Pakistani police, it's a lot of money, $3,000. And that was the reason for why they looked for foreigners, especially foreigners. It was easy made money for them. So because nobody was asked for the foreigners in Pakistan.
How were you treated in American prisons in Kandahar and at Guantanamo Bay?
So that's the point. Because they had no any, because they had nothing against me, because I was innocent, they tried to make me guilty. And how they did, they brought me papers, what used to say, I will never fight again with Al-Qaeda against Americans, and I'm a terrorist and whatever. And of course I refused because I'm not a terrorist. And because I never did fight with Al-Qaeda against Americans, I refused to sign it. And then they tortured me by electroshocks. They hanged me on chains for 5 days. And they used, it's called water treatment. They stick my head into water and hit me in the same time into my stomach. And all kind of torture you can just imagine. It's I had to stay in during the winter time and outside. There was not a prison in Kandahar during that time. And like 3 months later, they flew me. They told me they're going to bring me somewhere to shoot me, and they flew me to Guantanamo. And I had to stay many years over there. Even the American government himself said, beginning 2002, they said Murad Kunas, he got approved that he has not any connection with any terrorist groups, and this man is ready to go back home to Germany. And even after that, I had to stay like 4 more years in Guantanamo.
Now, why was that? Was the German government reluctant to take you back?
The American government asked the German government to come and bring me back home, to pick me up. And the German government, with no reason for, they refused. And I had to stay 4 more years, but the interrogations during my time were there never stopped, and they never stopped to force me to sign those papers, even after I got cleared that I'm innocent and not guilty. So all the years they tried to make me sign those papers, and because I didn't, they punished me every time again until I got released.
There may be people in our audience who are skeptical about your story, as I'm sure you would be aware. There are reports that Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, train people to say after they are released from American prisons that they have been tortured and that they were arrested for no reason and so on. Why should these people believe your story?
Why people do believe my story?
Yes.
Because everything is clearly, and everybody knows what's going on the world, around the world, and the wars everywhere, and where I got arrested, and about the bounties. So everything is very clearly. So what I'm trying to say is, I'm talking about the American government. They said that I'm innocent. Not anybody. The same government keeping me in prison said that I'm innocent.
And do you have documentary evidence of that they said that?
Yes, of course, yes.
Again, Murat Kurnaz is a former detainee at Guantanamo Bay. One more question, or at least one more question, but it's been reported. Well, let me go first back to Tom Lasseter and ask him this question, again, with the McClatchy newspapers, who's interviewed 66 of the people who've been released from Guantanamo Bay. One of the things that you report is that prisoners who were held under circumstances much like those described by Murat Kurnaz became more militant and anti-American as a result. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. The former detainees I spoke with pointed consistently to Bagram Air Base and Kandahar Airfield in Afghanistan as being far worse in terms of physical mistreatment, and by that I mean unprovoked physical assault, as being far worse than Guantanamo. And so if you have, let's say, you know, an Afghan detainee who was detained not because he was a militant, but let's say he killed an informant's cousin, and so the informant, looking to exact revenge, you know, tells the Americans this guy is he's a very large militant commander. He's then shifted to Kandahar and or Bagram, where for a long period of time there were isolation cells where detainees were hung by their wrists from the ceilings of these makeshift isolation cells. This is according to court-martial documents from the U.S. military. So this detainee has a rough time of it at Bagram and is then sent to Guantanamo. And at Guantanamo, you have not just Afghan sheep herders or young, you know, guys from Pakistan who went, just to pull off a few rounds of an AK-47. You also have hardcore jihadist fighters and imams from across the world. And so you put these different pools of types of detainees together, and certainly the more radical detainees took advantage of it to indoctrinate those detainees who were not radical to begin with. And over the course of being there for several years, you had a core group of militant detainee leadership that called for hunger strikes, would call for suicide attempts, would call for protests, essentially trying to wage an insurgency inside of Guantanamo. And so you certainly did, our reporting found, have men who, when they were detained, were the wrong guys, who were not who we were looking for, but that by the time they were released, had in fact been radicalized by the process.
Tom Lasseter, again, with McClatchy Newspapers, author of this 8-month investigation, or being released this week in five segments, by the McClatchy Newspapers around the country. We'll be back with him, with Murat Kurnaz and others, on To the Point on Reporter's Notebook a bit later. John McCain wants to relax the ban on offshore oil and gas drilling. What about, will that get him votes in Virginia? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point. We're talking today about a series in the McClatchy Newspapers, the headline of which is America's Prison for Terrorists Often Held the Wrong Men. They've talked to 66 of the prisoners released from Guantanamo. 500 have been released altogether of the 770 that originally were kept there. We've heard that most of the 66 were low-level Taliban grunts, as the term is, innocent Afghan villagers, ordinary criminals. In the case of Murat Kurnaz, a man of Turkish descent from Germany who was in Pakistan and turned into the American authorities by Pakistan police, who wanted to get the bounty that was made available to them. Ruel Gurecht is a former CIA officer in the Middle East. He's a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. That's a conservative think tank. He's also a contributing editor at the Weekly Standard, conservative paper, and contributing writer to the Atlantic Monthly, mainstream publication. Ruel Gurecht, always good to have you on our program.
My pleasure.
What do you say to what we have heard and to the headline, Americans Prison for Terrorists Often Held the Wrong Men? What went wrong?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's terribly surprising. This type of work is extremely difficult. And I know from my own work in the agency that mistakes happened all the time, that you couldn't trust debriefings unless you happened to know the case officer involved and you had a great deal of what you might call circumstantial knowledge, evidence on what was actually taking place. And when you think of the magnitude that we encountered after 9/11, and the fact that there were very, very few professional interrogators who were linguistically or culturally qualified, they were dependent upon translators, how many people they had to deal with, it's not at all surprising that a lot of people were scooped up. People who had no direct involvement, certainly with al-Qaeda, may have had more involvement to do with the Taliban, but even there, perhaps, as Mr. Lasseter said, were in the grunt category, that it would take time to sift through this. Now, it is regrettable to say it always takes more time than what one would like. And that's just the nature of the beast. That bureaucracies, military bureaucracies, intelligence bureaucracies, are not all that good. And that's true with the American. It's true with foreign intelligence services, too. It takes time. And also you have the problem in all of these places that once you develop a certain professional cadre, they usually get rotated out because they don't like staying in Afghanistan or they don't like staying in Iraq. I would suggest that I think at least in Iraq, they've gotten a lot better. I mean, Nick Robertson of CNN, I thought, did a superb piece on describing how the process of interrogation has evolved inside of Iraq, how the detainment of insurgents has evolved, how they've tried to adopt a much more sophisticated approach to those individuals who they don't think are hardcore or people that can be redeemed, and those who are really hardcore of isolating them from everybody else.
Well, we're talking about Guantanamo Bay here, though, and what about the report of Murat Kurnaz that we heard a moment ago, that even after the U.S. government said, wait a minute, we don't have any proof that this guy was any problem, it's time to turn him back to Germany, he still had to spend 4 years there while the circumstances were being worked out by the Germans, and he was still, he said, interrogated in the way that he had been before.
Well, it's difficult to comment on his case in particular without noting all the details. I would just say this, that it is odd, and I have no explanation for that, why the Germans initially didn't want him back. So, there may have been a gross miscarriage there. There may not have been. I don't know. It's not surprising that they would carry on debriefings at all. Without seeing more, it's difficult to say. It's not surprising at all that you would have military interrogations in Guantanamo would not be as perfect as we would want them. It's not surprising at all that a lot of people, for a whole variety of reasons, some of them quite understandable, are detained there for longer than what they should be. It's a difficult issue. It's a real conundrum, and certainly the Bush administration didn't do a brilliant job of figuring out how to handle these folks, how to politically handle the whole issue. I think slowly but surely we're getting better, but it's not surprising that a lot of people stayed there much longer than they should have.
Ruel Gerecht, again, former CIA officer and a fellow now at the American Enterprise Institute, as well as a journalist. The attorney for Murat Kurnaz, whom we heard from earlier, is Bahar Azmi. And Mr. Azmi, thank you for being with us, a professor at the Seton Hall Law School, and once again, attorney representing Mr. Kurnaz. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Why was it so difficult to get your client back to Germany?
It was difficult from a legal process because for the longest time there was no actual sort of traditional legal procedures in place by which we could present evidence of his innocence to a neutral decision maker and have that person rule that this person is in fact completely unconnected to terrorism. So he fell into this diplomatic Bermuda Triangle where the German government preferred not to have him back. The U.S. government continued to detain him and publicly defended his detention as lawful and continued to call him an enemy combatant while while privately and in now declassified documents, recognized he had no connection, and refused also to release him to Turkey. So he is a sort of paradigmatic case of someone who was mistakenly detained and got stuck in the bureaucratic and rule-less place in Guantanamo.
Since his release, and since you've been able to get a hold of these documents that were private at the time, has the government had any explanation for why it was that they continued to hold him and to treat him the way that they did?
The government has never publicly backed away from the claim that he is an enemy combatant, nor have they recognized the obvious factual mistakes that they've made in attempting to classify him as an enemy combatant. They maintain that he, like everyone else in Guantanamo, is who they say they who the detainees say they are, regardless of all the evidence to the contrary.
And again, you say you have evidence now that has been released, previously classified documents that indicate that they were saying something exactly the reverse.
That's right. As early as 2002, the United States concluded that he had no connections to al-Qaeda, Taliban, or any terrorist threat. Their communications to the Germans that led the Germans to believe that the U.S. considers his innocence, quote, proven. Documents that reveal the Germans communicated the United States he has no connections to al-Qaeda, yet the U.S. continued to classify him as an enemy combatant and argue that his detention was lawful. And that, to me, underscores the importance of this most recent decision by the Supreme Court last week in the Boumediene case, because it meant that sort of self-dealing and secrecy can't exist, that some sort of neutral tribunal has to examine the evidence underlying a particular case and in some sort of summary way determine whether or not a detention is lawful.
And what the U.S. Supreme Court said is that under the right of habeas corpus, Mr. Cournoz or now people who are still in Guantanamo have the right to challenge their detention in civilian court. That's not the same thing as asking to be released, is it?
Certainly not. That's the sort of mythology that people have been, who are upset with the decision has been propagating. All it requires is that the government defend the detention in some kind of summary proceeding before a neutral judge, a federal judge. And the Supreme Court suggested for cases like Cournoz's, where lawyers have uncovered evidence that the detention was a mistake, that they weren't in the place the government says they were at a particular time, that lawyer and the client should be able to present that evidence to a judge. It doesn't follow then that all the detainees will be released. Those who belong would stay, and those who arguably can show they had no connections to any lawful definition of an enemy combatant could be released.
Let me go back to Tom Lasseter with the McClatchy newspapers. It's reported that about 60 other prisoners at Guantanamo, in addition to those 500 that have been released, have been cleared for release but cannot be repatriated because their home countries, for one reason or another, refuse to have them. Do you know anything about that? Once again, your focus is on those who have already been released rather than those who are still there, so I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm just interested in how much you do know about it.
Right. Well, I know a little, and the little that I know suggests that it's very complicated, because as the gentleman was just saying, if the U.S. government has classified these men as combatants for a long period of time, their home countries will often be hesitant to take them, despite whatever's being said privately. You know, they certainly don't want a terrorist being shipped home. There are also concerns about how home countries will treat those former detainees, whether they'll face serious physical abuse or prolonged detention by security agencies in their home country. You know, that's certainly something we heard from former detainees from places like Jordan or Russia, or to a lesser extent Pakistan, being treated fairly roughly after being returned. Being called into security agencies frequently, whenever there was an attack, and the country, you know, these guys sort of get rounded up again, you know, for, you know, sort of going looking for the usual suspects. If there's a terrorist attack, of course, you're going to round up all the former Guantanamo detainees. And in some of these countries, there's a preference for confession versus evidence collecting. And if you've got these pool of former Guantanamo detainees, perhaps there's a temptation to coerce them into confessing to involvement with recent attacks. I think it's obviously very complex returning these guys home. And certainly if you've had detainees who've been radicalized at Guantanamo, trying to figure out what to do with them once they get back, it's something that particularly Afghan officials complained about, that it made it much difficult for them, you know, that they were, you know, allied with the Karzai government. These are people who are pushing for peace in Afghanistan, and they say it makes our job much more difficult when these guys come back, having been radicalized by their detention.
Real Grecht, back to you, our former CIA officer now at the American Enterprise Institute. Are you concerned because of the Supreme Court's decision that the prisoners do have a right to habeas corpus to challenge their detention when, as Mr. Osme pointed out, that doesn't mean that they're asking for release necessarily?
Yeah, I'm a bit uncomfortable with it. I mean, I just see a nightmare brewing of judges trying to assume the role of intelligence officers, and I just don't see it working. I mean, there are many different scenarios where you could have a certifiable terrorist under custody. You will want to keep him under custody, yet the information that you had certainly wouldn't match legal standards, whether it be liaison-provided information or intercept. And that's not to say that for a moment that mistakes aren't made in this process. That's why I think it would have been far, far better for both Congress and the President, the two war-making powers in the U.S. government, to politically, you know, work out a process and debate this process openly. You know, we didn't do that, and the courts have now stepped into this void. And I don't think it's a good thing. I fully understand. Certainly, if you were innocent and you were being held down there, you would want some means of redress. But again, this isn't an ideal solution by any means. And I think in the long run, maybe in the short run, what this could lead to, in combination with other factors that have sort of restricted the way we aggressively engage in counterterrorism, is that you're going to see the rebirth of rendition. I mean, there's a reason why the Clinton administration started rendition in the mid-1990s.
Rendition is when prisoners picked up by the United States, then turned over to some foreign power. Go ahead.
Foreign intelligence service to do the necessary debriefings, which usually are pretty coercive, far more than what the United States has ever engaged in. But the reason the Clinton administration did it is because they realized they were scared of all the possible juridical problems. They were scared of actually having to deal with the criminalization of terrorism. So it was much easier. They wanted the information. They wanted the intelligence. And so they started sending people abroad. The Bush administration continued that. They amplified it in certain cases. And I fear we're going to go back to that, because no president, be Democrat or Republican, if they believe that they have information that leads them to believe that there's a possible catastrophic terrorist attack, are going to say, no, we're going to abide by Marcus of Queensberry rules here. They're not going to do it. So where do they go? They will go back to rendition. So we have a problem here. It needs to be politically solved, and we haven't done that yet.
Now, let me go back to Bahar Osme, the lawyer for Murat Kurnaz, the former inmate at Guantanamo Bay, professor at Seton Hall Law School. What do you say to that? What about the possibility of resuming rendition and with the worst situation ending up resulting for the prisoners?
If I could first address the concern about the courts being able to handle these cases, I'm quite confident that these courts and these judges can manage the some of the peculiarities of these kinds of cases. That is, that there may be classified information involved, intelligence secrets. They handle these kinds of questions all the time in regular criminal courts and in sort of related procedures where national security secrets are involved. So I'm quite, I suspect that in my view, they'll be overly cautious, too cautious from my perspective in granting access to the kind of information lawyers would need to test these detentions.
Well, then what about this hypothesis that they have somebody they really think is, for whatever reasons, is going to commit terrorist acts, and in order to avoid whatever legal processes they might foresee, they turn them over to another government?
I think that's a possibility, but I don't think it's inevitable or necessarily desirable. I think, for example, the FBI agents have been able to conduct interrogations through lawful means without rendition processes prior to 9/11, and have been able to sort of win the trust of a particular detainee and get valuable intelligence that they've been able to use either as part of a criminal case or to share with hopefully share with other agencies as part of intelligence gathering apparatus. I mean, I think the prediction is possible, but I don't think it should follow, particularly in any sort of large-scale way.
But, Mr. Gorecht, you're just saying that you don't think that they're going to take the time to worry about the legal niceties, if you can refer to them that way.
No, I don't think they will. I mean, we're not, in any circumstances, we're not talking about a large number of people here. I mean, the situation we had after 9/11 probably won't be repeated. You don't know. I mean, what we would have to have happen is we would have to invade another area. Now, it is entirely possible that, let's say, things go to hell in a handbasket in northern Pakistan, in the northwest frontier area, then you could see American troops going in there and sweeping up a lot of people. And we will have to, once again, deal with how the difficulties of interrogation and what you do with these folks. But otherwise, no, you're talking about a relatively small number of people, but I just emphasize again, from an intelligence perspective, you will definitely go in the direction of rendition if you think you have someone who may have information of an imminent terrorist strike against the United States. They want to get that information, and okay, either Democrats or Republicans, they're going to go after it.
Murat Kurnaz, let me go back to you. Again, our former detainee at Guantanamo Bay, author of 5 Years of My Life, An Innocent Man in Guantanamo. You told us that you were in Pakistan helping homeless people, that you had already bought your ticket back to Germany, that you were arrested by Pakistani authorities who took a bounty then from the United States for turning you in. You were then subjected to abuses for a long time, including after the time that now unclassified documents show the government had agreed that you didn't do anything and weren't, in fact, guilty of terrorism. Did you become radicalized, and did you see that happening with other prisoners at Guantanamo Bay?
I know I don't blame the Americans for what was happened to me. It was the American government and not the Americans. I have many American friends today, and I don't blame Americans for the government, and I know very well there was many Americans tried to stop doing those things, there was many Americans tried to stop the government doing illegal detentions and imprisonment, and I don't have any problems with Americans. Just I saw also people got. I saw many kids over there with me together, 14 years old. The youngest was the youngest one was 9. The second youngest was 12. And if children or kids growing up in those conditions, it's they can get. They can get radical even if they wasn't.
Now, let me make you clear. You're saying there was a 9-year-old prisoner at Guantanamo Bay?
Yes.
Mr. Azmi,
was the youngest one. I myself was 19, and there was another. I had many neighbors with 14, and today they are still over there and already 20, 21 years old.
Very quickly, Tom Lasseter with the McClatchy newspapers. Did you find that, prisoners as young as that at Guantanamo Bay?
None of the men who I spoke with had been that young while they were there. No, the youngest were
in their late teens when they were picked up by the U.S.
Okay,
were just a few of the men who I interviewed. That was the exception.
Okay, understand. Tom Lasseter, once again, with the McClatchy Newspapers. Their series out this week, a five-part series interviewing 66 of the people released from Guantanamo Bay. Thank you for being with us today. Murat Kurnaz, thank you as well. Thanks to Bahar Asmi, the attorney for Murat Kurnaz and professor at Seton Hall Law School. And thanks to Ruhul Gurecht, former CIA officer, now contributing editor at the Weekly Standard and contributing writer to the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Good to have all of you on our program today. For decades, virtually all of the Atlantic and Pacific coasts and the Gulf of Mexico off Florida have been off limits to drilling for oil and gas. That's a ban supported by most Democrats, including Barack Obama. But Republican John McCain says it's time to give states incentives to permit more exploration. We'll have more on energy policy and the presidential campaign in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Governor Tim Kaine has broken with fellow Democrats and supported exploratory natural gas drilling off the coast of his state, Virginia. That, of course, is a state crucial to the hopes of both Barack Obama and John McCain. Stephen Power covers energy policy for The Wall Street Journal. And, Stephen, thanks a lot for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
What do you think the votes in Virginia have to do with the timing and location of Senator McCain's announcement that he'd like to see a change in the ban on exploratory drilling?
Sure. Well, let me step back and just explain for your listeners what the current policy is. For about 26 years now, the federal government has had a moratorium on drilling in the outer continental shelf along both the Atlantic and the Pacific coastlines. In recent years, the officials in the state of Virginia have indicated publicly that they are interested in doing, at the very least, exploratory drilling. That means just initial exploration of how much natural gas exists off their shoreline, because they think that could potentially be a benefit to the state. There could be royalties that could come from that. The governor of that state, Tim Kaine, is one of those officials who said he is open to exploratory drilling for natural gas. The state's Democratic Senator, James Webb, is also on record as favoring that, as is the current Republican Senator from Virginia, John Warner. What Senator McCain is proposing here is to allow states that want to permit exploration off their coasts to do so. He says he's trying to provide an avenue for states that want to allow that to happen, for that to be the case. What's blocked it in the past is that other states, including New Jersey, Florida, Connecticut, other states along the Atlantic seaboard, don't want to see any drilling occurring. They're afraid that if that happens, there will be accidents that could end up on their shorelines in the form of oil. So that's the basic overview of the situation.
So in the middle of a political campaign with energy prices going up, where does this put Barack Obama when it comes to the state of Virginia?
Well, Senator Obama is on record as opposing lifting the current moratorium on offshore drilling. So in this sort of one narrow area, he is not on the same page as Governor Kaine. I don't believe he's been specifically quizzed yet on the sort of the more narrow issue of should Virginia have an opportunity to permit exploration. But his official position, which his campaign was reiterating last night, is that he does oppose lifting the ban on offshore drilling along the Atlantic and Pacific coasts.
What about Senator McCain in terms of the environment in general, greenhouse gases? How different is he in terms of achieving goals which he shares with Barack Obama?
Yeah. Well, there are a number of differences between them. Again, I'll step back and just describe some of the similarities, because I think that's what people sometimes tend to focus on, is they both favor capping greenhouse gas emissions and setting up an emissions trading system where you would cap emissions of greenhouse gases across the economy and give permits to companies that they could trade if they wanted. If let's say one company emitted too much pollution in a given year, it could buy the right to emit more.
I'm going to interrupt you in the interest of time because I'm sorry we don't have as much time as we thought.
Okay.
Very quickly, the differences between the two.
The differences are that John McCain is very much a proponent of nuclear power. Senator Obama is very much much more cautious on the idea of nuclear power. Senator McCain's emissions reduction goals for greenhouse gases are more modest than Senator Obama's. He favors a 60% reduction by mid-century compared to an 80% reduction that Senator Obama favors. And also on ethanol, Senator McCain has a long record of opposing many forms of subsidies for corn ethanol. Senator Obama, being from Illinois, which is a big corn state, has a long record of favoring corn ethanol tax credits and other policies that benefit the corn ethanol industry. So there are a number of differences between them.
All right. I'm very sorry to have had to rush you. I get emails about that, and I apologize to our listeners as well. We simply ran out of time. But, of course, we'll be watching this to see how the energy issue shapes up in the campaign. Stephen Power with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks a lot.
Glad to be with you.
Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl with Dan Konecki and Karen Radziner, our technical director, Charlton Thorpe. For more information about To The Point or to email us, kcrw.com/To the Point. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.